Welcome to another episode of Sit Rep. I'm your host, U.S. Army combat veteran Greg Williams. To continue our series on the African American experience in the military, we decided to do something different. This whole entire episode, we're going to dedicate to one service member. Last June, we partnered with SAGE and the Generations Project to bring forth a storytelling event featuring LGBTQ veterans who served across all eras. This story that you're about to hear is from James Fitzgerald.
So coming up here, James, and you served in Afghanistan, right? Okay, so without any further ado, James Fitzgerald. Yay. And you're going to talk a little bit about Don't Ask, Don't Tell and what that was like, right? Okay, here you go.
So good morning, everyone. Good afternoon. I couldn't see my clock before I stepped up. It's a pleasure to be here. For those of you who detect my Southern accent, you are absolutely spot on. I'm James Fitzgerald, and I grew up in a very small town in Tennessee, just south of Nashville, called Columbia. My family, you know, Southern Baptist, you know, conservative leaning in their values. And that really didn't mean that much to me up until the point in time in which I was 13 and my older brother was 16. And my older brother had come out to my family. And for me, it was the first time that I understood what terror meant, because I had never seen this part of my family come out. And I had so many connections with various members of my family, specifically with a lot of the females, like my mother and my grandmother. And to see this side of them as my brother's coming out, on top of learning many new terms like gay, and that's not a good thing. It doesn't just mean happy. I understood what faggot meant that night. So as I'm watching this in the moment, I'm learning truly, this is my destiny. This is what's going to happen to me when I tell my family my secret. So I had made a decision at that point in time, as I'm watching this shocking and traumatic scene take place, that I'll never come out. I'll never have that happen to me. I'll never be put in a position in which this kind of exposure, you know, comes upon me. So fast forward to the point, and I'm 19. We're at a time of war. The country's calling for service. And for me, ever since I was a Cub Scout, Boy Scout, I understood that the quickest way to gain a connection to the world was through service. So, you know, I wanted to answer the nation's call. I wanted to give all I could to the nation that had given me so much opportunity to have freedom of maneuver, to do more than what generations prior had done. And the current ongoing practice in the military of don't ask, don't tell was already an applied practice in my life. I didn't want people to ask, and I certainly was not going to tell. So it wasn't a humongous change of pace whatsoever for me to join. I joined as an infantryman. I wanted to do the highest level of what I could of service. And, you know, being in combat arms, working with only men, it is not as fun as it sounds. It was the opposite of what I expected. Coming from that small town, being birthed into an entirely new community, I was introduced to so many different aspects of this country, of this world, that I'd never envisioned. Meeting people from Montana, from Indiana, from New York. They were assholes in the beginning. But it was just like, wow, I'm getting all this kind of exposure to things that I never knew about in Columbia, Tennessee. So I truly felt like my service to my country was showing me so many different layers that I never would have gotten any other way. So I'm loving my military experience. Don't Ask, Don't Tell had successfully enabled me to justify pushing down a part of myself that I'd hidden away for so long. And I'd successfully done it. I was great at my job in the military, but I was also great at suppressing that part of myself, great at hating that part of myself, great at promoting the things that go against my values and go against who I am. So when the time came about that we were in Afghanistan, I was with 101st Airborne, very high profile unit, very fancy. You know, we're doing great stuff with the best equipment, with the best personnel on the planet. So November 13th, 2010, I'm leading a squad. We're in Afghanistan. We're in Kandahar, which at that point in time, the UN had established that portion of Afghanistan as the most dangerous place in the world. So, you know, that was something I put on my Tinder profile. It was absolutely great. But November 13th was the day that we were ambushed during a combat operation. And I happened to be leading that particular operation. And I was up front with my second in command, my best friend, Josh, right beside me. And I was the first one to be struck during the ambush. And I was shot in my left thigh, which sent me flying off the side of the mountain. And I fell about 50 feet into a ravine where I fractured my knee and broke my femur in my right leg, and fractured my hip and broke my nose and some other stuff. So I was pretty messed up. And, you know, I genuinely thought that that was it. I was proud. I was proud of my service. I was proud of what I had accomplished in 24 years of life. And, you know, it was a point of honor to think that this is how, you know, other patriots feel when, you know, they think of, I hate that I only have one life to give to my country. So I understood that, you know, this is the check that I wrote to the country, and they're ready to cash it. And then I hear these bushes rustling, and then I get scared again, and I'm like, crap, you know, here we go. And it turns out to be Josh. And Josh was right next to me when I got shot and flew off the side of the mountain. He was the only person that saw where I had landed. And so, you know, after a little bit of searching, he was the one that found me. And as he comes up and starts assessing my injuries, I look up at him and notice that he's shot as well. But he's shot in the face. And his face is leaking blood. And like, we, you know, both acknowledge at this moment, it's like, hey, this is going to be it. It's like, we're going to be sharing these last moments together. You know, we're, you know, during the romantic comedy of, oh, I'm so glad it's with you. And, oh my goodness. It's, you know, you're wonderful. Oh no, you're wonderful. But we both acknowledged that, you know, we respected each other. We loved each other. And, you know, these were the moments that, you know, we're going to be our last. Thankfully, others found us and, you know, got us to safety. But I have to point out the fact that during those last moments, the thought came across my head, should I tell my best friend? Should I tell my brother in arms who I am? We're about to die. And then that same fear that I felt as 13, I felt at 24. My God, the new family that had accepted and loved me and cared for me for so long, are they going to reject me at this point in time when I come out? Is my best friend, is my brother going to reject me? Should I take this risk? And I chickened out, and I didn't say a word. I didn't say a thing. So a couple of years pass, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. I'm in an entirely new base. You know, everyone's, oh, James, you did great, blah, 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 blah. I'm teaching. Yet again, I don't say a word. And now it's authorized for me to tell all about myself, and I choose not to, in fear of losing my family again and again. So this theme of failure internally is having to be pushed down alongside of this individual that I have hidden away from the world for so long. And it was hidden behind the uniform. And now that the uniform was gone after I was medically retired in 2014, I moved to New York. I had another secret. I had fallen in love. I had moved in with a man that lived in Manhattan. And the time came to, you know, tell my family about the other person that I was living with, the man that I loved, this new life that I was beginning to live. And I kept making these trips back to Colombia with the full intent to tell them. It's like, oh, and I also have this wonderful guy I want you to meet. And each and every single time I failed. And I remember one conversation during my last trip. And it was about one of my cousins who had also came out. And my uncle and aunt didn't have the best response. And he tried to take his life. And he had overdosed on his medication. And he ended up in the hospital. And they were still relentless and their attacks. They just took it to new levels. And I'm just, yet again, watching in silence, not saying a word as this is going on. Then it dawns on me. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who I am, what I do. They're never going to accept me. This family is not ever going to accept this part of myself. And, you know, it came to pass that Time Magazine reached out to me to say, hey, you know, we're doing a Veterans Day issue. You know, we've heard about your story. We'd love to feature you. And I'm like, oh, perfect. That's great. So, you know, I scheduled this interview during this last visit to, you know, Columbia to, you know, tell the world, to tell my family. And me and my grandmother were gardening, and I'm explaining to her what Time Magazine is. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm sure you can get it in Columbia. Yeah, whatever. And, you know, we're, you know, having this, you know, normal moment between us to where we're doing this garden work and we're connecting. And I tell her, it's like, hey, I got to go make this call. And she's like, yeah, go do your thing. And before I hop on the call, I call my boyfriend. It's just like, oh, my God, you know, should I explain you? Should I, you know, bring you up? And he's like, it's completely up to you. It's your choice. Trust your gut. And I remember sitting in the backyard of my grandmother's home as I'm, you know, having this interview with this Time Magazine reporter. And it gets to the point of love. She's like, so do you feel like the love for your country has been justified? Do you feel like, you know, you're happy with what's going on? It's like, I feel happy that I have someone that loves and cares for me. She's like, oh, who is that? And it's like, ah. It's my boyfriend. Oh, and it was just like this weight had been lifted off my shoulders, and I couldn't shut up about, you know, my boyfriend and guys and, oh, yeah. I'm just like, oh. But then, you know, the fear came back and it's like, crap, now that this is going to happen, it's inevitable. And, you know, I still kind of chickened out because I got on the plane, came back to New York, and I felt relieved. But I knew that the magazine was eventually going to hit stands. They'll be able to read it at their leisure. They could find it at fine bookstores around the country. So it's like, oh, they'll definitely come across it. And so I just waited. I remember sitting in Morningside Park in the middle of the night, just under this street light, waiting for the phone calls to come rolling in. And it was call after call. They all followed the same thing. Hey, we've read the article. It's great, but there's some misprints in there. It says you have a boyfriend, and I think that was wrong. So you need to call them whenever you can. And also, what is this coming out? What were you coming out? Like, what is that? Where were you at? And it was like, this is weird. But I explained it, and I just remember just the feeling of how similar it was to that night when I was 13, watching all my family just converge on my brother and question and just like break him down. And then to fast forward to my experience, it's like, I still got it. They still were able to, you know, converge on me, but I got to do it on my own terms. I got to do it with pride. I got to do it with confidence in myself. I got to do it being who I am in a space that accepted me for who I am. So, you know, New York is my home. New York has been the first place that I've been able to be myself in. This is the first place that's accepted me for who I am. And so to have that full circle, you know, service to the country, and then to return and be in New York City, you know, it was a true honor. And to take all my experience, take all my knowledge, take all my skills to the current place that I work, which is Ally Fournier Center, which is the country's largest LGBTQ youth shelter, and step inside of those walls and provide an example to let them know that, you know, it may be rough sometimes, but it's worth it. And courage isn't having fear or being in a state where fear doesn't touch you. It's having that fear and still moving forward. And still being able to have pride and accept yourself. Sometimes that's the most courageous act we can always do. Thank you.
I felt back then that I only had one of two choices. And it was either a choice between being successful in the military or being gay. I couldn't have it both ways. I chose to be successful in the military, and part of, you know, my job in the infantry heavily relied on trust and respect. And so I was extremely fearful of not having the opportunity to gain the trust and respect of my peers and superiors by letting the fact be known that I was gay. So I kept that under wraps. And plus, it would have summarily had me dismissed from the military. That was just the climate back then. So it was something that at all costs was to be kept in the dark. And then the day came, November 13th, 2010. I was in the lead of our unit's movement, and we were ambushed. That was the day that I thought was going to be my last. I truly believed that I would not set foot on American soil again, and that, you know, I would see my last sunset in Afghanistan. I was afraid of certain aspects of the deployment, not necessarily of dying. I was more afraid of being maimed and captured. That was my greatest fear. But I came to realize that my true terror lived in people finding out that I was gay. I remember never regretting a single moment of my service either. And just thinking, it's like, yeah, you know, the world may never know this part of myself, but my God, you know, I am defined the very message that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was there to state, that because I'm gay, that I can't do the job. And it's like, they may not have known it, but for me, it was that point of satisfaction that I've done the job. I'm here. And I've done it to the best of my abilities, and I'm worthy.
Thank you for tuning into Sit Rep. This episode was produced and edited by Gil Feliciano and hosted by me, Greg Williams. Thanks for tuning in.